His answer came swiftly. It was not as expected.
She is calmer now. I put the pills in her tea.
What?
I crush them into powder, put them in her tea, every morning for the past 2 weeks.
She imagined it. Lucia's back turned, his hands shaking, the clink of the spoon as he stirred.
I'm sorry. I know this is wrong.
His voice choked.
No, Manny. Don't be sorry. Please.
He didn't know what else to do.
I understand. Of course.
She nodded into the phone.
And how is she?
She's been sleeping a lot. Yesterday she went to see a doctor.
He did not need her to come anymore.
But I've already booked a ticket. Are you sure?
I'm sure. I think it will be okay.
Miranda set down the phone, stupefied. Whether it was awe or horror, she could not say. But it was gratitude. Chapter 8. Manuel. He did not speak with Lucia about the incident or the pills or the new doctor she saw in Cuenca from time to time.
It's private, she said.
But this was what she'd always said. And so they returned once more to this delicate dance. He, terrified of re-triggering her anger, of launching her into another episode. She, resentful of his mistrust. He hated being her minder, her keeper.
You take care of it, he said,
and she said,
I will.
But nothing was truly different. Nothing made him feel safe. Only time would soften his vigilance, allow his anxiety to transition into relief. Slowly, they slipped back into their lives. He and Essie continued to paint the casita, polka dots, stripes. When his daughter had turned 5, they'd added 2 more rabbits, one on each side of the door, and then the pigs, Princess and Pea, and then Freddy, who they painted on the south-facing wall as tall as the roof, and then a cow named Victoria. Lucia seemed to flatten out, like a spinning coin laid to rest. She brought Essie to the river, taught her how to scrub underwear with a small rock against a bigger rock, where to lay clothes in the grass to catch the late afternoon sun. Yasmin was sent away. Lucia resumed work at the Gringo newspaper, too, though in some different capacity, commuted once every other week. She would start a new book, she said.
About what? He asked.
Healing,
she said.
And El Pollo? Unheard voices?
No, she said.
He was glad she read again to Essie every night, rotated through tall stacks of children's books borrowed from a used bookstore in Cuenca. Charlotte's Web, The Mouse and the Motorcycle, a dog-eared Spanish-English dictionary in which she'd highlighted her favorite words. Serendipitous, dulcet, vivir, querencia. One day she brought home a brochure for a girls' school in the city run by British expats.
What's this? He said.
Just to look at, she said. For when she's older, maybe. Essie is really smart.
One day she returned from a long afternoon in the woods, smiling. She had encountered a wise man, an old shaman, she said, who lived on the other side of the mountain.
You could meet him, she said.
Some other time, he said.
Thereafter she would often return with sprigs of herbs, seeds and seedlings, a vial of tincture, a crystal to hang in the window. She brewed tonics for Tio Remy's arthritis, Mommy's stomach pains, Tia Alba's cataracts, prescribed motherwort and licorice root for Tia Camila's night sweats and hot flashes.
This works? Asked Tia Camila.
She poked a finger at the sediments afloat in her cup. He could not look her in the eye, but Lucia did.
Try, she said. You have to try, Tia. And you have to believe.
He hath believed. And the half that did not humored her, downed bitter concoctions tasting of earth.
Ew, said Essie.
His daughter wrinkled her nose, zipped shut her lips, threw away the key. He recalled how he used to take her to the candy store, how their faces puckered sucking on lemon drops, how they stretched gummy worms to nearly a foot. By now she had long finished with the village daycare, wore a proper school uniform with a green plaid skirt she'd hike up past her knees whenever her mother wasn't looking. She no longer wore her hair in pigtails, rather a single braid down the middle of her back. Lucia taught her math.
How many pigs and chickens in a barnyard with 24 legs and 8 heads?
4 and 4, of course, said Essie.
One day Lucia brought home a violin she'd found at a pawn shop in Cuenca. The screeches hurt his ears.
Essie, practice out in the garden, he said.
But, Papi, she says, music is the language of the universe. Mama says.
One day he dug into his jacket pocket and found a wrinkled bus schedule. Quito to Esmeraldas. He tossed it into a garbage can. The paper fluttered. They spoke occasionally about having another child. He had always wanted more children, half a dozen, maybe more. She seemed fine, perfectly fine. He wanted to believe it, that she was cured. Those darkest images would fade, supplanted by new memories, but the knowledge of her illness haunted him still. They made love occasionally. He still saw Luna from time to time. Fabiana and Guadalupe had gotten married. And then Ricky, too, and Juan a few months later to Guadalupe's younger sister. And he could not help but wonder about her Peppa, whether it was stubbly or smooth. Soon he would have 2 brand new nieces. One day he came home to find long yellow streamers billowing out from every window of the casita. Essie had found the rolls of crepe paper in a drawer, spent the afternoon carefully hanging them with clear tape.
Hair, Papi, she proclaimed. Our casita has hair.
But the sight of streamers brought the Vargas house to mind. Susie. Was she still living in Esmeraldas? The thought needled him, like the splinters lodged in the palm of his hand. He believed they were content most of the time. Most evenings they ate dinner, played cards outside, or slipped over to Mommy's house to watch football on the new LCD television. Some nights Lucia still leafed through her narrow-ruled notebooks, carted out her old laptop. "What are you working on?" he asked. She had her own column now at the paper, could do as she liked, so it was ecotourism this month, an interview with the director of the senior center the next.
And the book?
She shook her head. 4 years passed. The dry season went, the wet season came. The animals grew and wandered and multiplied. When rains were severe, mud bubbled in through the seams of the casita and they lay down flattened cardboard and wore rain boots. Each time the tin roof started to leak again, he felt guilty for not having started work on a new house. There was always something else in need of his immediate attention. The future would have to wait. Essie was 9 years old when it happened. A cloudless spring day, ripe with lilac and chickweed and manzanilla. Essie, as tall as Mommy, gangly, lithe, with a shining brown face and dark teardrop eyes. On her 9th birthday, she had insisted on cutting her hair short. It reached just below her ears. She and Freddie were playing by the river, as they often did in the afternoons, building mud castles, digging moats, populating them with minnows and other small fish they could catch with their hands. It was one of the dogs who alerted her with its yelps and howls. Freddy had tumbled in. It wouldn't have mattered had it not been the wettest rainy season in 30 years, turning the river into waist-deep chocolate rapids. And it shouldn't have mattered because Freddy, though slow and thick as a dunce, was tall and knew how to swim. It was a trick, Essie thought. Gordita was playing a game and would burst out or wave his arms or grab her by the legs and yell, "Shark!" But as she waited around, his lumbering body did not surface. She screamed for help. Manny was close by, close enough to dive in, but the mud and sand and sediment were thick and opaque and he couldn't see.
"Donde? Donde?"
he screamed at his daughter as she pointed this way and that, until he stepped on the soft, bulky mass.
"Go get help!" he yelled. "Run and find your mother, abuelo, abuela. Tell them to go get help!"
It took all his strength to drag the body out. Freddy's lips were purple. His skin was white. He lay his brother on the grass, shook him by the shoulders. Poppy arrived first. He cleared Freddy's mouth with his fingers, tilted his head, blew air into his lungs, listened for the breath to return, and when it did not, he pumped hard on his youngest son's chest. It seemed a lifetime that the small crowd stood gathered, watching hopelessly, Mommy clutching Tia Camila's hand. Manny could see the whites of her eyes, pupils grown black, mouth gone slack. When she sagged by Freddy's feet, he ran to her, gathered her in his arms as her shoulders began to heave.
"Alamar,"
was all she said.
He was a boy again.
They were picnicking by the sea. It was not a day for mirth, but he was happy to be alive. He was a boy on the beach, belly full of fish and bread, skin hot and salty and crusted with sand. He found an orange starfish washed up by the waves. When Ricky pulled off one of its spiny arms, he wailed like it was he himself who had lost a limb.
"It'll grow back,"
Mommy had said.
He wrapped his hand around his brother's ankle. The skin felt cold.
"Come back,"
he begged. "Come back. Come back."
Essie sank to the ground, reached over to pat Freddy's bloated belly.
"Please come back," she whispered. "Gordito, I promise I'll be the shark next time."
She clenched her teeth. She would not cry.
And then a miracle. Freddy sputtered back to life.
It took 4 men to carry him home. An old door covered with towels as their stretcher. Freddy was placed in his bed, warmed with lamps and blankets and hot water bottles. He shivered. Mommy lay next to him, cradling his head in her bosom. Essie refused to leave his side. She told him jokes, made faces, anything to make Gordito laugh. Papi drove to Martez to find the doctor. Tia Paola peeled potatoes for soup. In the tense, uneven quiet, even Tia Camila had no words. He brought Essie crackers. He brought corn to the hens, scraps to the dogs. He wandered in and out, bedroom to kitchen, kitchen to yard, trying to find a place to stand still. Tia Camila offered him a cup of hot coffee. He was just sitting down to drink it when a knock came at the front door.
"¿Quién es?"
called Mommy. His legs buckled as he stood. It was Lucia, out of breath. She had run up the hill to call for help. Now, before him stood an ancient abuelo, face like an old record, carved with lines. He wore a crown of bright, multicolored feathers. A garland of beaded necklaces hung from his neck. The old shaman.
"Manny," said Lucia, still huffing, Where is Freddy? I've brought help.
The shaman looked at him with bloodshot eyes.
¿Quién es?
Called Mommy again. He tried to block the doorway with his body.
It's nothing,
he said. But Mommy had already padded out from the bedroom. One glance, and her complexion paled.
Please send that man away,
she said. He saw Lucia's confusion, her naked shame. That evening, on the front stoop of the casita under the spring moon, holding hands, he recounted to her the story of Freddy's birth. The round wooden tub. The shaman's words.
At best a dunce. That child is a curse.
Lucia's hands trembled. She bit her lip.
I'm sorry, she said. I didn't know. I thought maybe he could help.
She closed her eyes, fought back tears. The whole of her body shook. He pulled her head to his shoulder, pressed his cheek to hers. She smelled like grass. He loved her then. He loved the goodness of her. The doctor in Cuenca said it was Freddy's heart. It was getting too weak to circulate the blood through his body. Freddy had been born with this heart, a defective heart. It was a heart for a boy, not a man.
He will need an operation.
And if not?
Asked Mommy.
If not, said the doctor, I'm afraid he will die.
Papi was stoic, Mommy incensed. It made no difference that she'd known all her life that her son was doomed for this.
When?
She asked. The doctor shook his head.
Soon.
But they could not perform this type of operation here in Cuenca.
Why doesn't he go to Quito? Said Lucia. Surely in Quito there are doctors who can perform such an operation.
It was true. Things in Ecuador had changed in the 2 decades since Freddy's birth. Better hospitals, better technology, skilled surgeons who could fix things once thought unfixable.
Lucita is right, said Mommy. Of course we will try.
A rush of phone calls, appointments, and soon it was decided. Mommy and Papi and Tio Remy would go with Freddy to Quito. Tio Remy's daughter, the nurse, would meet them there.
I want to go too, said Essie.
No, hija, you stay, he said.
But he let her ride with them in the back of the truck, an hour and a half to the bus station in Cuenca. Freddy climbed on board first, pressed his nose to the grimy window. Mommy sat beside him, Papi and Tio Remy behind. Essie jumped up and down, waved and waved until the bus disappeared out of sight. He bought his daughter a soda. They sat down on a curb.
Papi, is Gordito going to die? She said.
He swallowed.
I don't know, he said.
But he can't die. He just can't. He's the only one of us who stays the same.
What do you mean, hija?
Her sigh made him feel obtuse.
Well, he's bigger now. Much bigger than when we first came, I think. But inside, he's the same. He laughs when I tell my jokes. He loves the animals. We play the same games. I love Gordito, Papi.
I know, he said. We all do.
She nodded, pensive.
And the rest of us, we're not the same.
She shook her head.
Abuela is worrying all the time now. She forgets things, like how much flour she's already put in when she's measuring the flour for honey cake. And Mama doesn't talk the way she used to. She's much more serious now.
And me, hija? Have I changed too?
She nodded. She pointed to his belly.
That's all,
he said, laughing.
You're heavier, she said.
She scrunched up her nose.
But not just on the outside, puppy. Inside, too.
He studied her face, wondered how much she knew, or if what she said was true, or if it was only that she was growing up and saw the world differently now. He had never spoken with her about her mother's illness, though he told himself he would, one day, but not now. For now, he would drink a soda with his 9-year-old wonder, and the past would stay in the past.
"Should we go to the candy store?" he said.
She grinned, slapped him an emphatic high five. That night, he and Lucia made love in the hammock outside the casita. After, they looked up, the fronds of banana trees swaying above them. They admired the stars.
"You have to believe," she said.
He nodded. He prayed. He tried to believe. 2 days later, Freddy returned from Quito with his entourage. He ran to greet them.
"Can they do it?" he asked.
Teoremi nodded.
"Yes?"
"There is a procedure," said Teoremi.
Papi stared at the ground.
"So they can do it. That's great, right?"
"Yes," said Mommy. "It's possible for the doctors to do it. But, hijo, it's too expensive."
He hadn't even considered it, the cost. But, of course, everything cost. Well, they could sell the animals. He could fix up the old tractor, sell that, too. He could find extra work in Cuenca, construction, painting, whatever it would take.
"Hijo, they say we don't have time," said Mommy.
"They could be wrong," said Teoremi.
"Doctors are wrong all the time," said Papi,
but his voice held no conviction. They sat at the picnic tables outside Mommy's house. He watched Freddy toss watermelon rinds to Princess and Pea. Essie sprayed their snouts with the hose. It was Lucia who asked,
"How much?"
Mommy glanced at Papi. They shook their heads.
"Please, how much?"
said Lucia. To him, it sounded like a staggering sum.
"I have some money," she said.
That night, he and Lucia lay in the hammock. He did not want to make love. He did not notice the stars.
"Are you sure?"
he said, a pit in his stomach. Lucia nodded.
"You have this kind of money?"
"I can get it," she said.
The next day she asked him to go with her to the Telefono Cabinica in town.
"Why?"
he asked.
"I need you to talk to my sister," she said.
He did not understand. To ask for money? No, no, he could not do that.
"Not about money. I need you to..."
She bit her lip, fidgeted with her fingers. He understood. They went by motorbike, bumpy and loud, reeking of petrol and kicking up dust. He sat beside her in that cramped, airless booth, on a metal stool so hot it burned his thigh. She handed him a slip of paper with the 10-digit number, but he knew it already by heart.
"Hello, Manny?"
Fear locked inside those two simple words. This was what he represented to Lucia's sister.
"Is everything okay?"
"Lucia is fine,"
he said, his voice sonorous, confident.
"She's perfect. She would like to speak to you."
He handed Lucia the receiver. It was a brief conversation. Lucia did not bother with pleasantries or attempt to mince words.
"This is about Freddy," she said,
her tone terse, restrained. And when she hung up the phone, she did not cheer or high-five, as he might have expected of her, but said only quietly,
Done.
He felt the contradiction. On one hand, elation. On the other, Lucia's coldness, which saddened him. But these were family matters, and he would not pry. The funds were wired the next afternoon. This is how Freddie went to the hospital in Quito and got an operation for his heart. The 8-hour procedure was completed without complication, allaying Mommy's lifetime of worry at last. Freddie arrived home to a quiet celebration. Tia Camila baked his favorite pineapple cake. Tia Paula hung streamers. Essie added a perfectly painted red heart to his portrait on the south-facing wall of the casita, next to the cow named Victoria. And though Freddie had never fully understood what was happening, now he clung to Lucia and wouldn't let go.
"Thank you, hija," said Mommy.
He squeezed Lucia's shoulders. Finally, the whispers stopped. And then one day she announced it. She was pregnant again. And when she said it, her face lit up and his lit up too, because he hadn't thought it was possible because she was too old for this.
"Yes, but I am blessed," she said.
She was buoyant, giddy. Essie the same, bouncing on the bed, overjoyed that she would become a big sister. She pressed her ear to her mother's belly, still flat.
"What shall we sing to the baby, Mama?" she asked.
"You choose," said Lucia.
He listened as they sang, their voices interwoven, almost indistinguishable now, in unison or in harmony, lullabies or boleros or American spirituals. "I've got peace like a river in my soul. I've got a river in my soul. I've got joy like a fountain in my soul. I've got a fountain in my soul." Even Mommy glowed. She plodded up the dirt path in her woolen shawl, carrying tamales or yapingachos or locro de papa. Then again, her reprise, the one she'd started almost a decade earlier,
"You will ask her now, hijo. For the baby, you must ask her."
So one day, he asked her. And she had a funny look on her face. But she said yes. Mommy clapped her hands, squealed like a girl.
"I will tell everyone this happy news," she said.
She kissed Lucia. She kissed her granddaughter. Then she pulled out her yellow measuring tape.
"I will make you a dress, a wedding dress, with sheets and sheets of lace and a beaded veil. Oh, Lucita, it will be beautiful."
It satisfied him, too. The three of them together, outside after dinner, heads close and clucking like gallinas. Then the doubts seeped in again. Her health. The health of the baby. Her health after the baby's birth. He'd kept those pamphlets given to him by that social worker. They were stored away in a trunk. He'd stored away the old yellow enamel pot, too. Purchased a new one. Stainless steel. But it had been years since he'd jumped out of bed to spy on her in the kitchen. He no longer knew where the orange bottle was kept. She saw the look on his face, kissed his cheek.
"Don't worry, Manny. I am taking care of this niña."
"How do you know it's a girl?" he asked.
"Well, wouldn't it be nice for Essie to have a sister?"
She saw this doctor, that doctor.
"I'm old," she said,
laughing. Her effervescence was contagious. She hummed a bachata and asked him to dance. She was perfect. Like the girl he'd first laid eyes on at the laundromat. That girl, the chinita with the perfect calves and perfect tetas. Now this woman once more carrying his child. It felt like a dream. Each night she brewed herself a cup of herbal tea, took her vitamins, stretched to relax. She went to bed early. She rubbed her belly. And for 9 more weeks they basked in each other's hazy glow, contemplating who this new creature might be who would join them. And then one night she sat in the outhouse for 6 hours, doubled over, and the next day the glow was gone. She did not cry or swear or holler out in grief. She made no sounds at all. Mommy put the dress away in a closet.
Such a shame.
Unlucky.
Cursed.
Then they did not speak any more about children. She lay in bed whole days, morning till night, walled in by the mosquito net, and would not answer when he asked what was wrong. She made appearances at family parties but mingled only with the teenagers, and she did not dance and never stayed for long.
She has a hole inside of her. Gigante.
Susie's words.
Lucia, please, you need to eat something, he said.
She shook her head. She no longer worked in the garden or commuted to Cuenca or wrote in the evenings in her spiral notebook. From time to time she went for walks by herself up the steep slopes behind the casita, through the grass to the woods, though she stayed away from the old shaman now. He watched as she set off, tall rubber rain boots marking her ascent up the hillside, 2 bright pink dots growing smaller and smaller until they disappeared. Only when she was completely out of sight could his tension transform into sadness. One day, as she lay sleeping, he noticed a single silvery strand of hair on her head. He could not remember how old she was. He had to think of his own age, then calculate hers. One day, their neighbor Roberto came to the door. There was a letter, he said, for Lucia. It had been delivered next door by mistake. A letter? What letter? They rarely received letters. Only the occasional package for Essie from Switzerland, with books or a sundress or a wide-brimmed hat, boxes of chocolates shaped like shells. Lucia, he called. She climbed out of bed. It was a large white envelope, thick and square, embossed with fancy gold type.
What is it? Asked Essie.
I don't know, she said.
She sat upright in the high-backed rocking chair in the corner of their bedroom.
Hija, you read it to me.
Essie took the envelope, ran her fingers over the fine linen paper.
It's beautiful, she said. Is it, Hija? New York University, said Essie. 25th reunion.
She glanced at her mother, who was resting again.
What's that for, Mama?
Lucia's eyes opened slowly. She rose from her chair.
How did they find me here?
She whispered. Without opening it, she threw the envelope into the trash.
Why is Mama so sad all the time?
Asked his daughter.
Sad?
She doesn't laugh anymore?
Yes, hija. She is sad right now. But one day she will feel better.
He cooked breakfast, chorizo with eggs, while Lucia slept. Essie set the table, went to the garden, returned with a papaya and 2 granadillas, perfectly ripe.
When?
She asked. He kissed the top of his daughter's head.
Soon, hija. She will feel better soon. I promise.
He said it to believe it. And because, well, in spite of everything, Lucia, their Lucia, had always come back. And then he felt a knot in his stomach, a strange remorse. He remembered still that promise he'd made all those years ago.
For my daughter, I will try.
he had kept the promise a long, long time.
He had stuck by Lucia. This was love, or this was duty. He could no longer tell the difference. That year, he finally laid the foundation for their new house, 60 meters to the right of the old one. Lucia sat on the front stoop of the casita, watching quietly.
"Come, Mama," said Essie.
A few weeks passed, and Lucia would help sometimes, hauling or shoveling or setting down joists. Then they mixed the mortar. Then they stacked cinder blocks. Then they pieced together the Spanish-tiled roof, sawed and framed and hammered and drilled. 2 bedrooms, a bathroom with a proper toilet and tub, a kitchen with porcelain tiles. They sanded and painted, installed windows and doors. One day he watched her wind up the dirt path carrying 3 reams of cloth, pink and orange and blue. She went to the old sewing machine Mommy had passed on to her years before, showed Essie how to sew a curtain.
"Like this."
"Like this, Mama?"
"Not like that. Like this."
He listened to them laugh. And then one day in the dry season she came to him. She said,
"Manny, I am going to America to visit my friend. He is dying."
She said it simply, but he could sense her distress. Her clavicles tensed. He did not need to ask which friend. He watched her take out her large red plaid suitcase, as ugly now as the day she'd brought it home from Orchard Street. She unzipped it, pulled out a small duffel bag. This was what she packed.
"How long will you be gone?" he asked.
"I'm not sure," she said.
He did not need to hear more, but she said it.
"I'd like to stay until the end."
She inhaled, exhaled, long deep breaths. Her clavicles relaxed. Her voice sounded stronger, determined. "Cancer. A few days, a few weeks. A month or two at the very most, if one had to guess." He remembered that hospital in Westchester. They had shaken hands. But now he felt none of the animosity he'd felt back then. He felt inexplicably sad.
"Mama, why do you have to go?" asked Essie. "It's only for a little while, Iha. A week or two, maybe. 14 days. Is 14 a lot, sweetheart?"
She reached for her daughter.
"It is," said Essie.
She threw her arms around her mother's neck. He drove her to Cuenca in their pickup truck, watched as she boarded the bus to Quito. She waved, he waved. She pressed her palm to the window. A lump popped into his throat. On the drive home, his head filled with memories of America. The Big Apple laundromat, Maurice, Angel Fountain spraying water from their penises, Mindy Griffin and the Vargas boys, Mrs. Gutierrez, the fires, snow. And once more he remembered those nights with Susie, entwined inextricably with his daughter's birth. He closed his eyes, heard the clang of the radiators, low muffle of the television tuned to Channel 9. The sirens wailed. He smelled smoke. He listened for Susie's footsteps. And when she came to him, he let her ride until he exploded. Those days imprinted upon him. The uncertainty and fear wore him down. But now, in the darkness, from his safe place in the campo, with his daughter sleeping soundly down the hall in her own bedroom, in the soft light of nostalgia, he could long for it now. Ache for the frenzy of youth. Where was Susie? That encounter with Nele Hernandez resurfaced in his mind.
Susie flourished in his imagination. Again, he fantasized a life with her the way he'd once dreamed of a life with Lucia, with half a dozen children and hot meals around a large table. Several weeks later, he found himself sleeping on a bus ride to Quito. It seemed the deepest sleep of his life. He did not notice the bumps or jolts, or the driver's sharp swerves to avoid slamming into cows in the road. When he woke, he watched the dirt cliffs zoom by, the petrol stations and car dealerships and banana plantations, open-air taverns with dry thatched roofs and men playing pool inside. In Quito, he boarded another bus. Construction and rubble and yellow machines, iron gates and billboards, stray dogs, plastic bags, telephone poles, graffiti-plastered cinder block walls, cement buildings spray-painted with notices and signs. Rubble, dirt, cement, trash. And then mountains and valleys. The blue-gray sky. In Esmeraldas, he asked the driver for the way to the barrio. Its name, stored for years in a corner of his mind, titillated as it rolled off his tongue. He was directed to another bus. By the time he arrived, it was dusk. One dusty main road, quiet, lined with low buildings, palm trees, telephone wires. He walked, glancing back over his shoulder every few seconds. The light was fading. His stomach growled. He had eaten nothing but candy all day. He needed to find dinner. A chicken cutlet or a piece of fried fish, cabbage salad, and rice or plantains. He smelled cooking from an open-air restaurant ahead. It was ramshackle, dimly lit, but he didn't care. There wasn't much else around. As he approached, he saw her. At a rickety table outside, in plain sight, as if she'd been set there to wait for a man just like him. She wore a tight black dress, several rings on her fingers. He looked down at the ground, shoved his hands in his pockets, headed for a large dumpster next to the low cement building. He squatted, hid. No, it was impossible. But yes, it was really her. It was Susie. With the same two small eyes, the dimpled smile, and a boy with her, maybe 8, maybe 9. They sat, licking popsicles. The boy in school uniform, navy blue trousers, a short-sleeved white shirt. The brown face, with Susie's small, wide-set eyes, the grin spread from ear to ear. He froze, calculated quickly in his head. No. But it was possible. Or it wasn't. Was it? He observed them, sick with doubt and disbelief and fascination. He could have stayed in that spot by the dumpster and watched them all night, the way they waved their hands as they spoke, the way the boy's dimples flashed as he laughed. He could stand up, walk, go to her. But he stayed squatting. Suddenly he could not think what good it could do to move. Would he say hello casually? Feign surprise? Apologize? Introduce himself to the boy? Would he pretend the encounter was an accident? Offer to buy them dinner? Invite them to live in the campo? About that boy, he didn't know. Couldn't be sure. But to step out would be to unravel a thread he could not sew back into place. So he stayed behind the trash. Hidden. Soon they were finished. Susie paid the bill. She stood and her dress hugged her heart-shaped ass. Her head lunged a split second ahead of her body like a giraffe. He was not ready to let them walk away, so he followed down the main calle, every gland excreting sweat. Once he thought she sensed she was being followed. She grabbed the boy by the elbow, raised her voice. They turned down an alley, and disappeared into a concrete building with an iron gate. He did not know what to do. He wanted to wait, to see them both again. He could go find a hotel, return in the morning, but his head felt too thick, his feet too heavy. He pressed his back against a wall, sat, drifted, not quite to sleep. He wished he had come sooner. That encounter with the sister, Nele, how long ago had it been? The boy, how old was he really? What was his name? He should have tried harder to track down Susie after she'd disappeared. Though if he'd found her, what would he have done? This was his way. All those years bound by Mommy's wishes, terrified of Migras. For what, he couldn't remember anymore. He had returned to his country, on his own terms. But no, they had never been his terms. They had always been Lucia's. All these years bound by Lucia, bound to the sister who was not even around. And now, here in this alley, finally here, and it was only because Lucia was away. If she had not gone, would he have come? Was this loyalty or laziness? He could not be sure. The clang of the gate woke him. Morning. The boy was leaving the building, so he followed him to school, studied every aspect of his gait. It was nothing like his. Was it? The boy was too young, wasn't he? His mind flip-flopping this way and that, and he could not be sure. Or, perhaps, rather, it could possibly be. He was not yet willing to release it because he needed this now, wanted it desperately, to prolong the story, to cling a moment longer to this piece of another life, the life of Manuel Vargas not lived. In the afternoon, the boy reemerged from school. He trailed him to the same rickety table outside the same dingy restaurant, and there was Susie again. They ate lunch. He could not hear her words, only the breath of her voice. The boy stood, wiped his chin with a napkin. Susie stood, smiled, and one tiny sliver inside him knew already, even as he wrestled with himself still. He would do nothing now. There was a word for this feeling. A Portuguese word he'd once learned from Lucia. Saudade. A vague longing for something that cannot exist again, or perhaps never existed. He cried into his hands. He returned to the campo. It felt peaceful there. He made peace for now. He had gone and come back and made peace. He enjoyed the quiet for now, and the comfort of his bed in his newly painted blue-gray bedroom in his newly built house. Ricky came to visit with his wife and two daughters. Juan came to visit with his wife and daughter and son. He enjoyed their company, their jokes, their allegiant admiration. He enjoyed this time with his daughter. Days later, he would begin his worry. Weeks later, he would receive the news. In shock, he would lumber down the hall to Essie's room, raise his fist, knock, knock. Sprawled on her pink bedspread, chin propped in one hand, she chewed bubble gum while reading a book. "Yeah," he said. He had to say it to believe it. "Your mother is not coming back." Part 3 Chapter 9 Yona.
It was a long time ago. Lucia said she's gonna come for a visit. Maybe 6 or 7 years. I wait for her to call me, but she doesn't call. I don't know what's going on. I don't hear from her anymore. I think, okay, she changed her mind. I try not to think about it. I don't take it personally. People say things, people do things. These two are not the same. I know that. I hope she's happy, that's all. I could have told her when I first started having pain in the balls. But why should I tell her, I think? She lives in South America with her family. I'm not gonna make special phone call just to tell her this. And anyway, if she hears it, she's gonna tell me to go see a doctor, and I hate doctors. And when I really need a doctor, I call Gia in Switzerland. Gia's husband is doctor. So Lucia doesn't come, it's okay. I know if something is really wrong, I hear from Gia. But then the day comes when I have to pee like crazy all the time. And I run to the bathroom and there is nothing, always nothing. So finally I go and get the tests. The doctors, they say, I'm a man, it's prostate, and this number is very bad, this number is a little bad, and maybe I do some procedure, and maybe it's gonna help me, or maybe it's not. Or maybe it's only going to change the numbers. I say, I don't care about any stupid numbers. I want to know, will it kill me? And if so, when? And what can they do so I don't have to pee so fucking bad all the time? They say, we watch it. So I say, okay, fine, we wait. And I go build a house in Meyer, Minnesota. Minnesota, sure, because it's far away. The land is cheap. The sky here, it's like crazy forever. You've never seen anything like it. So big and clear, you can see whole universe. But the winter, it's fucking cold like you can't believe it. You think New York is cold? No way. This place is freezing off your ass. And people ask, do I go ice fishing? And I look at them, I say, you think a Jew is gonna sit out on the ice 8 hours for a fish? So, in the winter, I go to Israel. I have a big, beautiful house there, near Haifa. And it's sunny all the time. But I can't take too much of Israelis and all the fucking politics, so in summer I come back to Meyer. All the people I know, they make fun of me. Look at me like this guy is crazy. And some people ask if it's near Minneapolis or a big mall or Lake Wobegon. No. But when I find out sometime later it's not only prostate, I have testicular cancer too. It turns out famous clinic is couple hours away. 2 months ago, the cancer shoots to my lungs. That's when I find her, Lucia. I call, and I tell her everything, and immediately she comes. From Ecuador. The lungs. I can't believe it didn't start there, she says. Always she's hated my smoking. You see, I tell her, I never do nothing wrong with my bowels. She is a little bit fatter, rounder face, heavier middle. But she is still beautiful. Beautiful dancing eyes. Beautiful smile. Like a girl. But now she's angry. She says, you tell me 5 years ago, I would have come 5 years ago, and now you're like this. You need a machine to help you pee. I laugh. And she has to start laughing too, because this is what me and Lucy do. I say, everybody's gonna die. She says, you should have told me. I say you have a daughter, you have family, you have a life. I know how to take care of myself. And she is crying, and I say, it's okay, sweetie. Hey, you're here with me now. Lucia, she drives to hospital. She's demanding to know the options. More options, she says. What are the options? She's trying to save me, but the cancer starts in testicles and spreads to kidneys and lungs by now. So then she flies to New York, only for one night, and she brings back a giant suitcase. Did you get that on Orchard Street? I say. She says, no, Orchard Street is different now. The suitcase is staffed with two things. Pineapple buns from my favorite bakery on Mott Street, and special Chinese herbs. You know these herbs, like dried up sticks and weeds and bags. Not something to put in your mouth. She cooks the herbs in a special pot, boils them all day and night, and the house stinks like worse than rot. I say, I am not dead yet. Are you trying to kill me? Get that shit out of my beautiful house. But I say it like talking heads say it. My beautiful house. And she knows I'm a little bit joking. Just drink it, she says. She hands me a bowl of black soup. Like tar for the roads, but full of twigs and tentacles and worms. I won't drink it, no way. She calls me stupid and stubborn. She is crying again, so finally I drink it. But I go to bathroom and spit it out. The next week my son, Johnny, comes. Johnny and me, we have a lot of rough times for some years. In New York, he tried to steal from me so many times. He makes trouble in the neighborhood. He gets his ass arrested. I say to his mother, how am I supposed to help a kid like this? I had to send him away. He's going to get himself killed here. She says, you are not sending him back. He is teenager. And she is not wanting him in the Israeli army. We have huge fights over this. Why not Israeli army? Everyone does Israeli army, even sissies, even girls. But instead of Israeli army, I send him to cooking school. And you know what? He does good. But then he comes to me, he says, Dad, I want to open a restaurant. I say, what do you know about running a restaurant? He says, what did you know about running a store? I say, every day I work at that store. I know everything going on in that store. Every delivery guy, every customer, every worker. What they do. Except Uncle Leo, he says, Johnny, my son, he knows how to hurt me. Drive a stick into my bowels and twist. You see, Leo, he steals from us too. My cousin, Moishe. He is partner of mine for the store. He learns about Leo. He is pissed. He blames me. He wants me to pay him back what Leo stole. So Moishe and me, we fight. I look for Leo, but when I finally find him, of course, the money is already gone. Money and family. It's hard to mix. But somehow we have to keep together in this country. Look out for each other. This is what we have to do. So I leave New York. I don't want to fight. It's best. I'm sick of it anyway. I want quiet. I want peace. I tell Johnny, you work in a restaurant business for 10 years. You prove to me you know restaurants. I help you start your own. Now, I don't have 10 years. Johnny, I worry about him. This time, he comes to my house. He puts his feet up on the coffee table, doesn't even take off his shoes. One thing, At least he can cook now. And this is good, because he takes over the kitchen and he won't let Lucy.